I'm going to leave 12 seconds here for the music to be added to this later this week. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell. I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, metaphysics, and today I'll add two museums to add to your bucket list that might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. The first museum is the Oceanographic Museum in Monaco. I love reading and learning about ocean life, and this museum is at the top of my list, along with the Monterey Bay Aquarium, of course. We visited Monaco a few years ago and spent a whole day there and still wished we had more time to take in the activities, the aquarium, educational programs, and the work done in the research labs. In case you didn't know, the Principality of Monaco is bordered by France on the north, east, and west, and on the south by the Mediterranean Sea. The museum was built by Prince Albert I of Monaco to provide a prestigious setting for publicly displaying the collections he brought back from his scientific expeditions. The museum has evolved new techniques in scuba diving, deep sea manned submersible vessels, submarines, satellite observations, and more. The museum reaches out to scientists around the world to assist in accurately reconstructing living coral reefs and undersea Mediterranean biotopes, which are particularly beautiful ecological communities. Visitors to the aquarium have the impression of actually diving into the natural environment. Prince Albert I was born in 1848 and lived until 1922. He dedicated an important part of his life to oceanography. When he was 17 years old, he enrolled in the Spanish Navy and 2 years later in the French Navy. In 1873, he purchased a 200-ton sailboat, the Hirondelle, and he traveled across the Mediterranean and the Atlantic all the way to the Azores. From 1884 to 1894, he acquired the knowledge to begin a magnificent career, not only as a mariner, but also a scientist. When his scientific collections were displayed at the Paris World Fair in 1889, there was such huge public interest, he developed a plan for the Oceanographic Museum. The cornerstone was laid in 1899, and it opened in 1910. In 1906, he also founded the Oceanographic Institute in Monaco as an independent institution recognized by the French government. The institute also has a location in Paris that offers a high-level education in oceanography for researchers and students. Prince Albert felt it was important to teach the general public about the ocean and offer free conferences on a regular basis. It also has a large library and publishes two scientific magazines. You know, I think you might enjoy part of the Prince's opening address in 1910. He begins, "Here you see that on the territory of Monaco has arisen a proud and inviolable temple dedicated to the new divinity which reigns over the intellect. As for me, I have lent the forces of my brain and my conscience and my sovereignty to the extension of scientific truth on the only ground where the elements of a stable civilization can mature, guaranteed against the inconstancy of human law. I hand this museum over to the servants of scientific truth. In it, they will find quiet independence and the emulation which fertilizes thought. When their thoughts wander from this monument over the blue waters, which veil the mystery of our origin, they can sweep all around the world, coming in contact with organisms which hand down to us the story of the ages. when they skirt the flank of our mountains or rest in their caverns or in the midst of the remains of dead generations, they can plunge into dreams called forth by the history of the earth. And if they mount to the summits which dominate all the horizons, they will easily reach the recesses of the universe, there to lose themselves in the secret of our destiny. What beautiful words. You know, when you approach this magnificent building by the sea, you'll immediately see that the founder wished to associate art with the sciences. Both inside and outside walls of the building are adorned with items made by the best artists and craftsmen at the time, depicting marine creatures, seascapes, or various symbolic features from the marine world. In summer, the museum's most popular activity for visitors is held three times a week using cutting-edge technology. Visitors sit in the lecture hall with a big screen that shows cameras following divers in the undersea reserve of Monaco. And visitors can converse directly with the divers as they show the beauty, diversity, and fragility of the Mediterranean environment and all its flora and fauna. On Wednesday afternoons in the conference hall, visitors can enjoy a presentation on the micro-aquarium, observing microscopic fauna that inhabits aquariums, as well as tiny animals in the Mediterranean Sea. Species as small as 0.3 millimeters to 1 centimeter are placed in the seawater underneath a big binocular magnifying glass that is lit up by optical fibers. One can see the slightest anatomical details of these animals, including their heartbeat and blood circulation. It's a museum tradition to display photographs to provide the public with education about animals they may never see. The photographs range from the first campaign of Prince Albert up to more modern times of Captain Jacques Cousteau's expedition, and of course Prince Albert II's expedition to the Arctic, and more. When it opened in 1910, the aquarium was far from what it is today. Prince Albert wanted it to be for research, but also an education opportunity for the public, so visitors could come to know and love the underwater world and be aware of the present threats to the environment. The aquarium has evolved into experiencing a voyage into the tropical seas of the whole world and a complete discovery of the Mediterranean. The aquarium holds about 6,000 fish, of which 250 are tropical, 100 are from the Mediterranean, and 200 invertebrate. The aquarium's coral reef is especially exciting. It began in 1989 when a large collaboration of experts moved part of a live coral reef in the Red Sea to the aquarium. It was carefully transferred in a special tank using micro-ocean water purification processes. The coral reef exhibits continue to grow, and they house just superb fish, flora, and fauna in the reef. Since corals grow continuously, these are propagated by cuttings, and now the exhibit contains a series of tropical tanks with over 70 coral species. Daily life inside the reef is an amazing variety of life. Many species live close together, while others are only associated temporarily, and others share their lives there permanently. For instance, you can see a green moreen eel that tolerates the presence of shrimp that clean its skin. Many small fish live within the branches of the coral. The anemone crab hides inside the stinging tentacles of a larger companion. Predators in the reef are often caught by surprise by the highly evolved defense systems of some fish. Sturgeon fish have two erectile spines on either side of their tail to defend themselves. And the filament-finned stinger has powerful venom in their fins that can be dangerous to humans. In stressful situations, the soap fish releases toxins into the water to poison their aggressor. And the balloon fish inflates its stomach with so much water, its physical volume triples and it discourages intruders. You know, there are predators in all levels of the food chain. The frogfish has a terribly efficient system of a fishing rod, where fish are snapped up without even being aware of it. And the lionfish unfolds a vast array of fins to corner its victims and then swallows them in a flash. Well, and then when you think you're feeling very overloaded at seeing so much, you go into the shark lagoon. It takes up two floors of the aquarium and has four viewing areas where majestic rays move about in front of the coral, and it's teeming with tropical fish. And the deeper part of the lagoon faces the open sea with sharks, rays, groupers, jacks, and moray eels. At the end of the day, we were in awe seeing the 90 tanks with such a variety of fish and sea life and learning about the complexity of feeding all these little guys. Not all little. Feeding requirements include shrimp fish or frog fish, the moray eel, stonefish. That moray eel has to be fed by hand or with forceps. Now, isn't that weird? The variety of food includes fresh and frozen fish, sardines, pollock, dogfish, shelled mussels, crustaceans, shrimp, crabs, krill, cuttlefish, squid, octopus, and now, you're not going to guess this, hundreds of heads of lettuce. Since I'm such a book lover, perhaps someday I'll be able to spend time in one of the oldest and richest collections of oceanographic works in Europe, which is in Monaco. The museum's library contains over 28,000 works, 3,500 series of periodicals, of which several come to them every year from 77 countries, as well as a large selection devoted to oceanographic expedition reports. I don't know, but I think it would be fun to curl up in a soft chair and read the daily diaries of an Arctic expedition. But guess what? The library collections are being computerized to make all documents available to users anywhere in the world. Another way to enjoy the museum is on the internet. If you Google TripAdvisor and you put in the name of the museum, you can enjoy over 5,000 photos of the whole museum and aquarium complex. Now that, to me, is a nice way to spend time. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805, or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through careasy.org. And if you have any questions, give us a call, 1-855-500-7433. The next museum experience I'm excited to share with you is described in the Smithsonian's official guide to the National Air and Space Museum, which is in Washington, D.C. The museum opened on July 1, 1976, with the goal of bringing to you a first-hand impression of how aviation and spaceflight have changed the way in which we travel by air, prepare for national defense, study the Earth and its resources, and explore the solar system and the universe beyond. The first collection they received was 20 Chinese kites that had been displayed at the 1876 American Centennial Exposition. It was given to the institution in 1882 by the Chinese Imperial Commission. And these 20 kites seeded the idea that would later become the largest collection of aviation and space artifacts in the world. In the early 20th century, progress in human-powered flight was so fast that by the end of World War I, Charles Walcott, 4th Secretary, directed that significant aircraft be collected by the institution. To oversee this growing collection, a section of the Aerodynamics and the Division of Engineering was established at the Smithsonian, and a systematic effort to collect the most important examples of aircraft led to a national collection distinguished by many firsts, one-of-a-kind, and historically significant artifacts. By the end of World War I, the aeronautical collection exceeded the institution's capacity to house it, And so it expanded to a hut in the War Department's property, and it became known as the Tin Shed. And the new building opened to the public in 1920 and finally remained in use for the next 55 years. Throughout the next 50 years, as technology included to advance, the collection expanded to include artifacts related to rocketry and spaceflight. It became clear that the museum was entering a new phase. On August 12, 1946, President Harry Truman established the Smithsonian's National Air Museum. The purpose? To memorialize, the development of aviation, to collect, preserve, and display aeronautical equipment, and provide educational material for the study of aviation. In 1966, President Lyndon Johnson signed a law that changed the name of the National Air Museum to the National Air and Space Museum to include both the development of aviation and space flight. The institution's mission and rocket collection began in 1936 with a Goddard rocket that was expanded, and some of the missiles were located outdoor in an area known as Rocket Row. When we were there and visited, the exhibitions ranged from a vivid recounting of the beginnings of flight to the latest techniques of remote sensing and aerospace applications of the new thing called the computer. In the theater, we watched an IMAX giant screen film called Blue Planet, and that showed breathtaking views of Earth as seen from space, and it described the natural and man-made forces changing our environment. We walked through the Milestones of Flight Gallery with objects that made the dream of flight a reality. The 1903 Wright Flyer is the focal point. Although it's fragile now, it's composed of wood and fabric and braced with steel wire. That achieved a balance between lightness and strength. The Wright brothers constructed it in their bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio, and sent it by rail to the coastal dunes of Kitty Hawk in Northern California for its flight trials. Another noteworthy aircraft was the 1896 Langley Aerodrome Model Number 5. I don't really remember what that looks like, but anyway, the Langley demonstrated the possibility of mechanical flight and was powered by a little steam engine. It flew twice in the afternoon of 1896, launched from a houseboat on the Potomac River. Now, that design, when they made it into a larger craft, failed to fly at all, and so that dream was abandoned. We admired the Spirit of St. Louis, an airplane whose history is perhaps matched only by the Wright Flyer and Apollo 11. It was built in San Diego for a 25-year-old airmail pilot, Charles Lindbergh. He took off from Roosevelt Field in Long Island early on the morning of May 20th, 1927, and he attempted to fly solo across the North Atlantic. It was interesting to see the way they had the plane balanced. For him to see forward, he had to use a periscope because a gas tank was installed where the windshield would have been. After flying 33 and a half hours in the air using his periscope, he landed near Paris to the cheers of over 100,000 people witnessing the first solo crossing of a major ocean by air. Then we were tickled to see the Bell X-1 named Glamorous Glennis, which flew about 20 years after the Lindbergh flight. Maybe you remember. I know I remember. It was flown by Captain Charles Yeager in the U.S. Air Force, and it was named after his wife. And she flew faster than the speed of sound, which opened up a new era towards spaceflight. And then there was the North American X-15, a rocket-powered craft that spearheaded research in hypersonic aerodynamics, winged re-entry from space, and life support systems for spacecraft. It spanned the gap between flight in the atmosphere and flight into space. Only 8 pilots qualified to fly this rocket. They received their wings by exceeding a 50-mile altitude on the X-15. And, you know, this was important in our life, my husband and I, because we actually met a neighbor in Igo who was one of those eight pilots that flew the X-15. And did he have stories? And it was inspirational to see John Glenn's Friendship 7 sitting less than 20 feet on the museum floor from the Wright Flyer, but separated by 59 years in time. Also, in this milestone of flight gallery is the two-seat Gemini 4 spacecraft from which Edward White ventured out from on the first spacewalk. We were also impressed with Apollo 11 command module Columbia that carried astronauts to the moon and back. It was in July 1969 when that first manned lunar landing happened, and I remember it clearly. We were driving on the interstate in Ohio, and we had taken a small portable TV with us and a generator, and we had the radio on so we could stop and pull over when it was time to watch the landing on TV, and I will never forget that. Other craft you'll see at the museum include a replica of Russian Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth in 1957, which was followed by our Explorer number 1 satellite that orbited the Earth in 1958. And next, Mariner 2, our first successful interplanetary probe to explore the environment of another planet. And Pioneer 10 was our first flyby of Jupiter. And the Viking lander was our first spacecraft to view Mars sitting directly on the Mars surface. And then, I kind of hate to say it, but we really weren't impressed looking at the moon rock samples, these small little gray rocks. What it took to get them, though, was impressive. You know, the museum had a total of 25 galleries with equipment exhibits on air transportation, vertical flight, Jedi aviation, flight testing, looking at Earth, stars, the lunar exploration vehicles, rocketry, space flight, sea air operations, the World War I aviation, World War II aviation, balloons and airships, much beyond the limits. And that brings me to an update. The museum has been closed for several years for extensive remodeling and updating 23 of the galleries. The good news is that it reopens in less than 2 months from now, in October 2022. And here's a description of some of what you will now enjoy. The Kenneth C. Griffin Exploring the Planets exhibition. It will probe the science and history of our understanding of planets and moons. The exhibition will be arranged around dynamic, immersive, immense audiovisual experiences to stimulate different planetary landscapes and present visitors with a view of standing on other planets. Now, I can't imagine that. That would be quite fascinating. The Destination Moon exhibit will explore the extraordinary combination of motivations, resources, and technologies that made it possible for humans to go to the moon. Highlights will include Apollo 11 Command Module Columbia, Neil Armstrong's Apollo 11 spacesuit, and the Saturn V engine. The One World Connected exhibit will tell the story of how flight fostered two momentous changes in everyday life: the ease in making connections across vast different distances, and the new perspective of Earth as our home. It'll feature an array of satellites and ask visitors to consider how global interconnection touches their lives, and imagine how advances in technology might impact our future. You know, between the first flights at Kitty Hawk and the opening guns of World War I, the design and construction of aircraft and engines became a global industrial enterprise. The early flight exhibit, when it's open, will use artifacts such as the 1909 Wright military flyer to explore the impact of the airplane on politics and international relations. Mechanical interactive displays will allow visitors to operate different types of control systems and interact with the digital representations of early aviation pioneers. The Nation of Speed exhibit will recount humankind's desire to become the fastest on land, sea, air, and space in the pursuit of commerce, power, and prestige. This new gallery will be a portrait of human ingenuity and will explore how the pursuit of speed has changed American culture and our national identity. Yes, and the speed of cars on the highway now after the pandemic, people just love speed. Anyway, the Wright Brothers exhibition will provide visitors unprecedented access to the 1903 Wright Flyer, while unraveling the story of its invention and innovation. The America by Air exhibit will explore the history of air transportation in America and the ways that improvements in technology have revolutionized air travel. It's interesting to think that the collection that started in 1876 with a group of 20 kites given to us by the Chinese has grown to nearly 60,000 objects. A large portion of the major objects are on display either at the museum or on loan to other institutions around the world. Many more remain in storage. The museum remains the preeminent American institution for commemorating flight while collecting, preserving, and presenting the history, science, and technology of aviation and space exploration. The museum also plays a pivotal role in planetary research through its Center for Earth and Planetary Studies. You know, I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the Oceanographic Museum in Monaco, and especially the coral reef exhibits, and the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum's revitalization and reopening in October this year. You know, this show's a little short today, but I'm sure there's going to be some commercials inserted in here that will just make you laugh. And the music that opened this show is from an acoustical guitar CD by the Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses. And it even comes with a full color booklet on their adventures. So until next week, may peace be with you.